You're listening to Language Nerds Do Earth, the podcast about linguistics, culture, travel, and how they're all connected. Now, it's time for your language nerd hosts. One in China, one in Spain. It's Patrice and Rachel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Patrice.
And I'm Rachel.
And we are here after the Easter holiday in the U.S., so I hope everybody had a great long weekend.
Yep. In Spain, we had a long weekend, too. And I know you have a long weekend coming up, so It's good to have some time off and enjoy the nicer weather.
Yeah. Yes, celebrate the changing of the seasons. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's what we're going to be talking about in this episode today.
Yeah.
But first, let's start out with some interesting language news.
Yeah. So, Patrice, I'll let you go ahead and start talking about it.
Yeah. So, actually, this week, it isn't really language news. I posted about it on Instagram, but it's something incredibly interesting to me. I've been listening to this book called The Language Instinct by Steven Pinker. Mm-hmm. And he talks about how a language often comes into being. So what happens is you have immigrants coming from two different places with two different languages. Then they have to communicate with each other. So they borrow words from each other's language to form a common communication, which becomes a pidgin. And then you teach that pidgin to a child who is of the language acquisition age, and the kid fills in the gaps where the pidgin is lacking, like a formal grammar structure and rules. A population of children will come together and just accidentally agree upon complicated grammar structures, and then it becomes a Creole. So we see this in Hawaii, when the Japanese and Filipinos came over in the 1800s to work in Hawaii, they formed a common language, and then their offspring took that language and made basically what, if you go to Hawaii, you hear the usage of verbs as adjectives, and it's a little bit different from the English that we speak in the mainland U.S., but it's still derived from English, and it's a Creole from the English that their parents spoke, basically, in order to communicate with other immigrants. Does that make sense?
That's so cool. Yeah. I also read that there's some debate about how long it takes to become a Creole.
Huh.
Might be like one generation, or it might be like 20 to 30 years for it to fully develop into a Creole. And I was reading about some other places that there are Creoles. So like in Haiti, it's a combination of French and West African.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
As well as
New Orleans has a Creole.
New Orleans, exactly. Mm-hmm. In the Philippines, there is Chavacano, which is a Spanish-based Creole.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
And Gullah in the United States, which is spoken in South Carolina.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. Well, this phenomenon is also really interestingly seen in deaf children. And actually, in Nicaragua, there was a school of deaf children in the 70s. Prior to this, deaf people in Nicaragua had no language. And they were just basically forced to learn how to lip read, and they were completely isolated from each other, so it was impossible for them to make a language. And then in the 70s, there was a change of regime in the Nicaraguan government, and all the deaf children were sent to a school where they were still taught how to lip read, but on the playground, they were developing their own form of communication with each other, so they had new movements that they made. They were just kind of agreeing upon signs that they were using. And then over the years, their kind of bigger movements were modified a little bit more and a little bit more. And then about 10 years after the beginning of that school, that language became its own system of speaking with grammar structure and a little bit more fluid. So now those kids who developed the language, I guess they would be in their 40s now, mm-hmm. 40s or 50s. And so the ones in their 30s and 40s, their way of speaking is a lot more fluid, and the younger ones, they changed the language too. So it just kind of shows you, like, people tend to get a little bit worked up about, you know, all these young people and their new words. But young people, they change language. That's just their natural instinct.
Interesting. Well, that actually kind of just, maybe it's a silly way, but it reminds me of just technology.
Yeah.
And the people who kind of, I guess, invented a lot of the computer software and whatever, mm-hmm. They probably aren't as fluent in new technologies as the younger generations.
Exactly. Progress is inevitable. Cool.
All right. Well, let's move on to our main topic, mm-hmm. which is spring festivals.
Yay!
Okay. So when we were talking about it, there are just so many. Mm-hmm. And so we basically picked out our favorite ones, or ones that we also thought represented different things. Mm-hmm. And we kind of broke it into three categories. So we have first religious festivals. We have ones that are all about flowers. And then we have what we'll call our mixed bag. It's got mm-hmm. a little bit of everything in there.
Yeah, it's, I thought of it as just cool, kind of quirky ones, basically.
Yeah, I think you'll see when we get there.
Yeah.
Some of them are quite interesting.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so starting with religious holidays, we have Semana Santa. I'm just going to talk about Semana Santa, which is Holy Week, uh-huh. In Spain. So Holy Week is the week before Easter, starting with Palm Sunday. In Spain, it's a pretty big deal, especially, let's say, in Andalusia, in the south, as well as a couple other parts. But in Andalusia, that's where it's very, very famous.
Mm. Okay.
So I think the first thing that you would kind of notice about it, especially if you come from the United States, is the traditional robes that people wear during processions.
Oh, really? Are they like purple robes?
They can be different colors.
Okay.
But what's, I guess, kind of alarming or startling about them is they really look like, it's like a long robe with a hood that's pointed.
Oh, yeah, that is a little alarming.
So it looks very much like the KKK, but I mean, it has nothing to do with it.
Yeah, I think I looked up pictures of that when I was doing some research for this week. I think I did see those pictures and I was like, did you see that when you were in Salamanca?
Yeah. Oh. Yeah, I've seen it in Salamanca and in Madrid. I think last year I saw it in Barcelona too.
Wow. Yeah, so they have hoods, right? The hoods cover their whole faces?
Exactly. They're just like two little eye holes. But yeah, they can be from different colors. So I think what it is they're like penitent. Is that the word?
Penance? Okay. Are they punishing themselves for their sins?
They're called the Nazarenos.
Okay.
And they walk like in front of the procession. They walk like in silence, sometimes barefoot.
Oh, really? They're barefoot?
Sometimes, yeah. And the point of the hood is like to hide their face. Mm-hmm. So the color of the robe is distinctive for each brotherhood. So there are a bunch of religious brotherhoods.
Catholic brotherhoods, obviously.
Yes. Sometimes I also read that they are shackled.
Oh.
So it's like a pretty intense Catholic thing.
So, sorry, Nazareno, would we translate that as...
I have no idea, actually.
Well, nacer is to be born.
Okay, yeah.
Right?
But it's with a Z.
Nazareth.
So I was thinking it was like Nazareth.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So people
but
from
I don't,
Nazareth.
But I'm not religious, so I don't know what that means. It's just a word that I
Nazareth know. Is where Jesus was born.
Okay.
I'm really going back far into my mental history of Catholic church school. So
you'll find processions in pretty much any city you go to in Spain. But the really very famous ones happen in Sevilla or Granada, Malaga, a lot of them in Andalusia. So they have these huge, I guess you could call them like a float. It's not exactly a float, but they're called pasos. And basically it's a huge wooden structure with a depiction of either Jesus or the Virgin Mary. And they're very, very elaborate,
wow.
Like with gold, and it's like a very detailed scene. But they weigh like 4,000 pounds.
Oh my God.
And they're carried by men.
Oh my God. How many men?
It's something like between like 30 and 50. And they're just walking under there,
wow.
Like in the dark, very slow, deliberate steps. Actually, when I was in Cordoba last year, we saw like a rehearsal for that. And it was very, very intense. Move like 6 inches per step.
Did they look like they were struggling?
Well, you really can't see them because there's like velvet that covers like all the way down to their ankles or something like that.
So they don't even get the glory of carrying this float thing.
No.
They're just underneath it?
Yeah.
God, that's terrifying.
And the name of them is the costaleros. Oh, and they each support about 50 kilograms or 110 pounds for approximately 8 hours.
Oh my God.
It's very, very intense.
That's a little suicidal. I guess, like, people carry that much weight, right? But 110 pounds for 8 hours, probably 8 hours straight. You can't, like, take a lunch break.
You can't, yeah, you can't just, like, set it down.
I'll be right back.
So, yeah, it's very intense, especially in the south of Spain.
I wonder if anybody gets back damage from this.
Would think. I don't really see how it's unavoidable.
Yeah. I'm really fixated on it. Sorry, we can keep going.
Okay.
Okay, well, another religious holiday is Holi, which... I would love to go to India for Holi. Actually, my husband and I were just out at an Indian restaurant last night, and we've been to Nepal, but we haven't been to India, and he's not really interested in going to India.
Mm-hmm.
But I was telling him, I know you're not really interested in going to India, but I really want to go to India for Holi, because it just looks like so much fun.
It looks amazing.
Yeah. So, a little bit of background for you. Holi officially ushers in spring. It has some mythological origins, but basically on the eve of Holi, the celebrations begin with a bonfire in which an effigy of the demoness Holika is burned, and this symbolizes the triumph of good over evil. And then after the bonfire, that's when everybody starts hitting each other with colorful powders. So Holi also symbols the arrival of spring, the end of winter, and for many, it's a festive day to meet others, to play and laugh, to forget and forgive, and to repair broken relationships. It's also celebrated with water, and it lasts for, like, all night and the entire next day.
Wow.
Right? It sounds like so much fun.
It sounds so cool. And this is a Hindu thing, right?
Yes.
Okay.
It's a Hindu holiday, yeah. It also, it kind of sounds like a lot of stuff combined into one, because it's also celebrated as a Thanksgiving for a good harvest.
Oh.
Yeah. And it's meant to destroy internal evil.
Very cool. My university, they used to do a holy thing every year.
No way.
Yeah, and I never went to it because I never knew what it was. And I would just see people after the fact, covered in color. And I was like, oh, man, I missed it again. But I think I was always in studying for finals or something.
Bummer. I've only done, like, the color run, which was really cool. But it's not holy. I want the real thing. I imagine that in India, it's a lot messier and a lot more unpredictable, because you just hit strangers. You just throw color everywhere.
Yeah. Sounds so cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you haven't seen pictures of it, it's gorgeous. And we're going to put some pictures up in the show notes of some of the different festivals that we talked about.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So the last religious festival we're going to talk about is the spring equinox in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So it's celebrated around March 20th or the 21st. I guess it depends on the year. Mm-hmm. So it's celebrated at several archaeological sites. It's kind of an interesting mixture of native religion, and it seems like it's very touristic now as well. It's celebrated at Teotihuacan, at Chichen Itza.
Oh, Chichen Itza. Uh-huh.
I think it's more popular at Teotihuacan, but basically people will climb up to the top of the Pyramid of the Sun, and they do these rituals and stretch out their arms to receive the special energy that is believed to be present on that day. And it looks really cool. It seems that it's now really touristic, as I said. It's limited a lot by how many people can go. It's a really popular place to go, and they put a lot of scaffolding and stuff up, which, I mean, makes sense. You don't want thousands of people going up to the top of this pyramid and, like, falling off. But
Well, and it's a piece of history. It's, like, 1,000 years old or almost 2,000 years old. So it's not good to have too many people tramping around on it.
Yeah, also true.
Yeah.
But it's really cool because at Chichen Itza, on the autumn and spring equinoxes, the sun, it makes a serpent going down the steps of the pyramid, which is only visible like between 4 o'clock and 5 o'clock on that day, and maybe a couple days around there, but it's the best on that day, which is so cool.
That is so amazing. Yeah, was it the Mayans or the Aztecs?
The Mayans.
Okay, yeah. The Mayans were just geniuses at using the light from the sun to be manipulated in architecture so that you saw it at a certain time from a certain viewpoint. Have you been to Chichen Itza or Teotihuacan?
I have, yeah. I was younger, though. But I was recently in Machu Picchu, and they have a similar thing, like, but I think it's more of the winter solstice. The light will come through this arch at like 12 o'clock, and that's the only time that it comes through perfectly and like makes this shape to complete another shape. It's so cool.
It's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, I went to Teotihuacan last year, and I've been to Chichen Itza. Chichen Itza, I thought, is really steep. So it seems like it would be really difficult to climb that. When I went to Teotihuacan, we climbed the pyramid, and it was so high. I think there were like 400 steps or something. And then there actually isn't that much room on top anyway, so that it's understandable that they don't let too many people on at once.
Yeah. All right. So let's go ahead and talk about some of the really cool flower festivals that we have.
Oh, yeah. So we were going to start off with the cherry blossom festivals. Obviously, they have cherry blossom festivals in Japan, but you also went to one in D.C. when you were in school.
Yeah, and the one in D.C. started because there was a gift from the mayor of Tokyo in, like, 1912 of 3,000 cherry trees.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, so it's all by the waterfront, sorry, by the tidal basin. It's amazing. Have you been during spring to see the cherry blossoms in D.C.?
I haven't, no.
They're so beautiful. Really? It's like everywhere you go. Although, so they have a cherry blossom festival that happens, it's about like 3 weeks, I think, of activities and concerts and stuff like that. But when I lived there during college, every time the cherry blossoms either bloomed way too early or way too late. So they were never in bloom during the festival.
Aww.
It was a bummer. But they're still beautiful no matter what.
Yeah. Well, I know when I lived in Korea, they had cherry blossoms all over the city where I lived, Gwangju. And they would come into season, obviously, in the spring. And they were so beautiful. And then when the blossoms started falling, it was like this warm snow for like a week and a half or 2 weeks. Petals littering the sidewalk in our neighborhood all over the place.
That's so true.
It's gorgeous.
Love it.
Yeah. Actually, also in Korea, there's another festival that is called the Maewa Festival, which is a lot like the Cherry Blossom Festival, except it is in it's in the south. And I went to this festival. The Maewa Festival takes place a little bit before the Cherry Blossom Festival. It is Plum Blossom Festival. So they have these plum trees that bloom. I think they're like a light pink and white. And then they produce this fruit. Okay, it's this very tart little green plum. Or apricot, I'm not really sure. But then everybody takes these plums and they pickle them. They use one part plum and one part sugar.
Wow.
So it's a lot of sugar. And they put them together, and after 100 days, you have this delicious pickled plum. In Korean, it's called maeshil. And most people who know me know that I'm a little obsessed with maeshil. I don't know what it is. It tastes a little like wine, but it's sweet.
Mm-hmm.
So like tart, sweet wine. My husband likes to say they taste a lot like baked apples.
Oh.
But they're a lot more crisp than that. You're supposed to eat it like after a meal because it's pickled. So fermented products are really good for your digestion. And you're only supposed to eat like one plum per day. But I would sit there and, like, go through half a kilo in, like, half an hour.
Oh, my God.
They're so good. And the worst part is you can't buy pickled plums in the store. You can only buy them at this festival, or you make friends with a Korean person whose grandmother pickles plums.
Mm.
And then just beg them for their pickled plums, which I did shamelessly. pretty much I would meet a Korean person, we would start talking, and I would be like, by the way, does your grandmother pickle maeshil? Because I'm completely serious, I want it. And they'd be like, ha 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 ha, that's hilarious. And I'd be like, okay, it's funny, but it's true. Like, what do I have to do to get your maeshil?
Did you ever get any?
Yes, I did. Several times.
Very nice.
People would give me maeshil. Yeah. I would be a little bit more polite about it, I guess. But yeah, there were some very nice Koreans who gave me their grandmother's maeshil. So
they're like, this poor foreign girl.
But anyway, sorry. I get really absorbed in maeshil. At the festival, they also have like maeshil flavored ice cream. Ooh. And you walk through all the trees and it's gorgeous. And they also sell this root tea, which is just ground up root combined with a little water.
Huh.
And tastes exactly like what you would imagine tree tastes like. term.
So not great.
Yeah, not great. They don't even combine it with nacial, so what's the point, really? I don't know why I ate that, so. Anyway,
you're drinking nature.
Yes. Okay. I think nature needs to stay in the ground where it was meant to be.
Okay. So another really big flower festival is the... Oh, I'm going to butcher this name as well. It's in Dutch. So the Bloemenkorso.
Yeah, I think it's the Bloemenkorso.
Okay.
Bloemenkorso.
Something like that. I really don't speak Dutch, but it's a flower parade. And it's one of the biggest in the world. So the Netherlands is really famous for their tulips. And so this parade goes through, I think it's like 8 towns, and it's a 42-kilometer route.
Yeah.
Which in miles, I don't know.
Yeah.
20-something miles.
Mm-hmm. Something like
and
that.
And it's crazy. I've been looking at pictures of it, and all the floats are just made of flowers.
Yeah.
Like, I think my favorite one that I've seen was, like, minions. It was, like, 8 minions, just, like, 10 foot tall, made of flowers.
Unbelievable.
So beautiful.
Mm-hmm. They're, like, tall as a house.
Yeah. And I think the Netherlands is one of the world's top producer of tulips, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the parade goes by Keukenhof, which is one of the world's largest flower gardens. Just full of 7 million flower bulbs.
Wow, 7 million.
Yeah, it's 79 acres large, this flower garden.
Wow. I think it's really interesting. We found some other flower festivals, and I think most cities or countries have some type of flower festival or celebrating the beauty of spring. And I know, like, even in where we're from, Knoxville, they have, like, the Dogwood Arts Festival, which is, like, you can go and see people's beautiful gardens, and I guess they have concerts and things like that.
Yeah, that's really nice. I love festivals. I love it when people come together to celebrate something.
Yeah, and it's, like, an excuse to get outside after you've been trapped inside, and you get to see pretty things. And
Yeah, it's interesting. Really nice. It seems like most of these festivals we're looking at actually take place during the daytime, which makes sense because you've been cooped up all through the winter, and you want to get out and see the sunshine, so.
Yeah. Okay, so now I think we'll move on to our mixed bag interesting festivals.
Yeah, this weekend in China is a festival called the Qingming Festival. It's tomb sweeping, and it falls in the third lunar month, so this year that's going to be April 5th, 6th, and 7th. On most days of the year, cemeteries in Hong Kong are avoided, but in the Qingming Festival, people go to their ancestors' tombs to clean them. So it's literally the tomb sweeping festival. Qingming translates into clean and bright. And I was talking to one of my coworkers about this yesterday, who was on her way home to visit her parents for the Qingming Festival. And I said, so what do you do? She said, oh, we sweep the tomb, we make it clean. You know, this tomb where my family's going is at the top of a mountain, so we'll climb a mountain and go see our ancestors. We have 5 generations of ancestors in this tomb.
Wow.
So we'll clean it and leave offerings like food and flowers. And they also burn money so that their ancestors can have money in the afterlife.
Yeah.
They also, you know, take this time to catch up with their ancestors. I'm doing well. Thanks to you. Thank you for giving me my life, etc. So she's there telling me about this centuries-old tradition of tomb sweeping. And I'm like, well, in the U.S., we have, you know, Jesus rose from the dead. And then there's the rabbit who lays eggs in the grass. Filled with candy.
Totally logical.
Yeah, I actually looked it up, and the ancient Greeks, they believed that rabbits could reproduce as virgins. That's why rabbits are associated with the Virgin Mary.
Oh.
And eggs are also associated with fertility.
Okay.
Yeah, so that kind of made me feel a little bit better about my conversation with her. Eggs and rabbits. And she's like, my ancestors.
Well, that's, yeah. I love that tradition. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It's really nice that they stay connected to people from their past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she asked me, actually, like, what do you guys do for your ancestors? I was like, we might go visit their grave sites, but I don't know where my great-grandfather's grave site is.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think it's really nice to...
Yeah. So I'm going to talk about Sechseleuten.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a festival in Switzerland, and I'm kind of obsessed with it. It's pretty awesome. So basically, they explode a snowman to celebrate spring, which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's like, get out of here, like, winter.
Yeah. Who came up with this?
Nobody wants you anymore. But, okay, so it goes back to the 16th mm-hmm. century. So the Swiss used to work only until the sun went down during uh-huh. winter. But in spring, they would work longer uh-huh. until 6 and then stop, which Sechseleuten uh-huh. means like 6 ringing of the bells or something.
Okay. Oh.
I'm not finding that, but I did read something about that.
That makes sense.
And so it's basically like a 10-foot, 12-foot high snowman. And they light it on fire at like 6 o'clock. And so the faster the fire gets to the snowman and makes the head explode, the better the weather will be during the summer. And I guess, so they put fireworks in the head to make it more dramatic.
That is amazing.
And it looks so cool.
Yeah. Did you find pictures?
Yeah. And it looks pretty badass. Yeah, so it's, I think, again, it's kind of people go out and they celebrate. It's around 6, so I guess it's still light mm-hmm. at that time. They're eating and they're having fun.
They're partying. Partying like the Swiss.
They're like, get out of here, snowman.
Yeah. Yeah, that's awesome. I've never heard of this, but it is so appropriate for saying goodbye to winter, especially in Europe. I feel mm-hmm. like you really, really feel winter. You can't hide yeah. from it.
Especially in Switzerland, where it's so cold.
Yeah, and mountainous. Exactly.
Yeah.
I remember when I was studying abroad in Germany, my birthday is in November, and that's why I remember specifically that for the month of November, I saw the sun for one afternoon, and it wasn't my birthday. It was so bad. It was really cloudy. So I think in winter in that region in general just gets like really depressing. So I would Oof. Also want to blow something up when it's over, just like, get me out of here.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
So why don't you talk about your favorite one?
Yeah, so this was really, just really interesting. It's on all the lists for most interesting spring festivals. But there's mm-hmm. not a lot of information about it on the interwebs. Basically, it's in Bosnia, and I'm sure I'm not going to say this right, but Simburijada or Simburijada or Simburijada. I got nothing. But people gather by a river in a park, and thousands, apparently thousands, show up to this festival. And they prepare scrambled eggs. This enormous skillet of scrambled eggs with spring onions. Can't forget the spring onions.
Of course not.
Yeah. And they just share it with friends and visitors in the city. It marks the first day of spring, and eggs symbolize new life. So, it sounds kind of laid back, you know, just like, we're all going to eat breakfast together. But they eat breakfast, and then they celebrate and hang out in the park for the rest of the day. I watched a YouTube video of it, but it looked like on this day, Simburijada was on a rainy day. So, not quite as festive.
It's pretty cool, though. Just sit outside and eat eggs.
Yeah.
As you do.
Yeah. That's where I like to eat my eggs.
So, another one I really like takes place in Poland. Also, I think I read the Czech Republic and Slovenia. Mm-hmm. And it's called The Drowning of the Marjanana. Mm-hmm. So, basically, Marjanana is the Frost Maiden and the Winter Witch.
Okay.
So each year they make like a figure of a woman. And I read some things where like children will like torture the thing or like play with it. And then a lot of times they light it on fire and then they throw it into the river. So it's like to kill or to bury winter to welcome spring. And, you know, all that good stuff like rebirth and new crops.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to the snowman explosion.
Yeah, it's very similar. It's from a similar area. I mean, a cold European area.
Yeah.
But I also read something about how it's sort of like a witch burning.
Huh.
It's similar in nature, like they burn it. And then throw it in the river, just for good measure, to make sure she's dead. And the Marjanana symbolizes, like, disease, death, starvation, and all evil.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, get rid of that. Get that out of here.
Of course it's like a female effigy, but...
Yeah.
Yep.
We've also got one more in our mixed bag of festivals, which is the Songkran Water Festival in Thailand. And my aunt actually lives in Thailand.
And she sent us this recording explaining the Songkran Water Festival.
In Thailand, the Spring Festival is the New Year celebration, just like it is in Cambodia, Laos, and Sri Lanka too. Sanuk is the Thai word for fun, and that is what the New Year holiday has to be. In Thailand, you don't celebrate or party for the New Year, you play.
Ugh.
And playing means throwing water.
I love that.
On everybody else, any way you can throw it. Big plastic water cannons start appearing in shops right after they take down the decorations for the Western New Year, which Thailand also celebrates because it's Sanuk.
Isn't that fun? Thailand also celebrates the Western New Year. But basically, they just like to have fun in Thailand. So they celebrate the Western New Year,
that's so
and then
cool.
It's their water festival.
And when is that?
The Thai New Year's Day is April 13th every year.
Oh.
But the holiday period includes April 14th to 15th.
Okay.
It's believed to wash away bad luck.
Oh. So
the Thais are very focused on luck and karma.
Oh, wow.
I like that, washing away the bad luck.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So it seems like we've seen a lot of festivals that are about renewal or...
starting again.
Yeah.
Fertility.
Which I guess is what spring is all about.
Yeah.
Okay. So now it's time for our Lost in Translation. We have a voice memo from one of our listeners.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So this is from... a listener, Kiara.
Let's see what she has to say.
Hi, everyone. My name's Kiara. I really liked last week's episode. I loved the Lost in Translation segment, which made me think of my own Lost in Translation situation. So I've lived in Spain for almost 4 years, and when I first got here, I didn't know any words. I didn't know anything. And I've made a lot of mistakes, and I still make mistakes, but probably the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened to me was I was trying to say hen in Spanish for maybe 6 months, and I was just saying it so wrong, and no one told me. In Spanish, pollo is chicken, and in Spanish, usually you put an A for feminine and an O for masculine, like perro, perra. So I would say pollo for chicken, and for hen, I'd say polla. Little did I know that pollo is chicken and polla is dick. So that was a very big mistake, very embarrassing, and I was saying it for about 6 months before anyone bothered to correct me.
Oh, no.
Oh, God.
So, but why was she talking about hens? That's what I want to know.
That's actually a really valid question. I don't usually talk about hens that much, but
maybe there were hens in her daily life.
I don't know.
Laying eggs or something. Speaking of spring.
Could be.
Oh, man.
Could be. I love that. It's so funny that no one corrected her.
Yeah, like the poor girl. Like, obviously she wasn't trying to talk about. I wonder how many Spaniards just were sitting there, like, chuckling without her realizing it.
Probably a lot. It's a pretty strong word.
Yeah. Do you know if it's like a used as a dirty word or if it's...
Yeah, it's a strong word.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kira. That is really bizarre. Real bummer that happened to be what you were not trying to say at all.
Yeah, thank you so much for sending in that hilarious story.
Yeah.
It's going to make me chuckle for a while.
Yeah, cool. All right, well... I think that's pretty much everything we've got for episode 3.
And thank you so much for tuning in.
If you have your own lost in translation story, we would love to hear it from you. You can email us a voice memo at languagenerdsdoearth@gmail.com, or you can write a comment into our contact section at languagenerdsdoearth.com.
Mm-hmm. And go over to our show notes for this week, and you can see pictures of some of these festivals, really beautiful mm-hmm. things, and
yeah.
Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter.
Mm-hmm. And thank you so much for listening. We will see you next week.
Have a good one.
Happy team swimming.
Bye.